Thank you very much, Lord, and I'm thankful to the organizer for bringing me here in the conditions and for organizing my stay. So, globalization is often conceived of as a recent phenomenon and as a trend which favors the dialogue and exchange between cultures. But if you consider that globalization was a watchword for neoliberal policies, which replaced that of development in order to foster the opening of national borders to the free circulation of goods and capital, we should also remember that state borders have been historically set precisely in order to regulate the circulation of goods and protect the national production since the 17th century. Immanuel Wallerstein and the French historian Fernand Braudel traces back to the 17th century the emergence of a world system of unequal economic exchange between the centers and the peripheries of the system. This model applies to the book market. So I will first develop from a global perspective the socio-historical approach of this market and its recent evolutions, mainly around translation, and we will check whether globalization contributes to cultural diversity through translation. Then I will compare the position of translation in French and American publishing to centers of this global book market. So the oldest among the cultural industries, the printing industry, was concentrated from the outset around some cities like Leipzig, London or Paris. They became cultural capitals with the help of the political power that reinforced the monopoly to the detriment of the periphery, their monopoly to the detriment of the periphery through protectionist laws on copyright. In return, the printing industry played a crucial role in the building of national identities as shown by Benedict Anderson. Paralleling this, the capitalist impulse to conquest new markets in association with imperialist cultural policies gave birth to transnational book markets in the Spanish, English, German, French linguistic areas, which were dominated by these same cultural centers. Like the provinces, the colonized territories, as well as the areas under the cultural hegemony of these centers, were relegated to the periphery of the book market. Consequently, in this market, territories are defined by linguistic areas and by the nation-states altogether, which do not, as you know, overlap necessarily. Yet the hegemony of the cultural centers, mainly French and the British ones, were challenged by the affirmation of national identities. The United States combated British hegemony in the Anglophone area by developing an autonomous national literature which emerged in the late 19th century, and also developing a book industry which succeeded in reversing the power relation only in the 1960s. The domination of French firms in the Francophone area, which was challenged by Belgian publishers since the beginning of the 19th century without success, is being fought today by publishers from Quebec, thanks to national policies supporting the local cultural industry. As a result of the building of national identities, translation became, from the mid-19th century onward, the main mode of transnational circulation of books. While Balzac's novels were widely read in Europe in French, Zola's novels were read in translation by a much larger public. Paradoxically, translation favored the codification of national languages, the importation of literary models, as showed by Itamar Evenzor and Pascal Casanova, and it also favored the development of publishing in many countries. Nation states became active agents of what had become an international book market, international linking nations, of course. So that the internationalization process was strongly linked to the nationalization of culture. There were more and more people and bodies professionalizing in the intermediation between cultures, literary agents, publishers, translators, state representatives of cultural policies. Yet the exchange between center and periphery did not become equal. Translation flows move mainly from the center to the periphery. French and English were the most translated languages. German entered the competition the interwar period. The Italian fascist regime tried to reinforce the place of Italian on this international scene. Scandinavian literature also gained some prestige on the international scene by the end of the 19th century with Ibsen, Strindberg, moving from the periphery to the semi-periphery. The world market of translation was limited to Europe, opening to American literature in the 1930s with figures like Faulkner and Los Passos. Tagore was one of the rare non-Western translated authors by that time. Thus, you can see that as a transnational transfer Translation first presupposes a space of international relations constituted from the existence of nation states and linguistic groups linked to each other by relations of competition and rivalry. To understand the act of translating, one should, in the first stage, analyze it as embedded within power relations among countries and their languages. These power relations are of three types: political, economic, and cultural. The asymmetry in the flows of translation reflects the articulation of these three factors. There is, of course, an economic dimension, because we speak about an industry and the trade, publishing. The structure of the market explains the fact that translations, like exportations, circulate principally from the center toward the periphery. Yet, this asymmetry does not simply reflect the size of the markets. Political and cultural factors take part in structuring the circulation space for written text, as, for example, in the competition among nations for cultural hegemony, or in the symbolic capital accrued in a literary or scientific domain. And there are works, many works now being done on communist and fascist regimes showing the impact of these political factors. Nation states are still a relevant unit, not only because legal borders, copyright, censorship, customs, but also because of cultural policies, especially translation policies. Many countries developed such policies during the globalization era, as we will see. So here we see how economic logic and political logic can be interweaved. Moreover, the balance of power between these factors can vary in different contexts. After World War II, while the United States was becoming dominant and the market of translation opened to non-Western literature, and to the it was under the impulse of UNESCO, which launched a program to subsidize translations from Chinese, Japanese, Indian, and Latin American literature. And there was specific series that were created. For instance, Gallimard publisher created a series called Connaissance de l'Orient at the time. So, in this context, the economic dimension became more and more constraining with the United States becoming dominant, and the global market for movies, records, and more slowly books emerged as exchange was being liberalized within the framework of international negotiations, notably the GATT agreements, which reflected the dominant position the United States had acquired. This exchange was accelerated in the 1980s, especially during the Uruguay round of the GATT negotiations beginning in 1986, which aimed at extending the free exchange agreements into the service trade, and hence into immaterial and uncorporeal goods, including cultural products. This evolution was counterbalanced by political and economic factors. A dissent arose, led by French representatives, who argued that cultural products were not random commodities and should be protected from purely mercantile mechanisms. And in 1993, as you know, the European Parliament adopted the principle of cultural exception. But this notion was considered too protectionist and elitist, since it included only works that had gained legitimacy as high culture in the Western world. And UNESCO played a major role in proposing the notion of cultural diversity, which refers to the anthropological notion of culture and includes linguistic diversity. And in 2001, UNESCO adopted the Convention on the Protection of Cultural Diversity. In the book industry, globalization fostered the unification of global markets. The multiplication since the 1980s of specific organizations like the international book fairs from Peking to Guadalajara through New Delhi and Ouagadougou is altogether the symptom and one of the mechanisms of this unification. The fall of the communist regimes and of the dictatorships in Spain, Portugal, and Latin America opened the borders and entailed a reconfiguration of the power relations structuring this market, with Russia, which had enjoyed hegemony in Eastern Europe, moving from center to semi-periphery, and Spain threatening its position. While multinational conglomerates appeared, the role of nation states, which were formerly central actors organizing that international book market, began to decline. This is a more general aspect of globalization, of course, but it has not disappeared. Nation states are still active agents in the world market of translation, not only because of national borders, which determine the conditions of circulation of books, but also because of the national policies of support to translation, which I have already mentioned. So usually they should support their own literary and intellectual production in other languages. And these policies increased the number of translations. It is also important to mention that denationalization does not mean deterritorialization. On the contrary, the competition on territories of book copyright is harsher than ever. English, American, French, and Spanish publishers tend to demand exclusive rights for the whole language-speaking area. All the more since the development of sales through the internet, which solved the problem of local distribution. Or they tend to struggle over the list of territories appended to their copyright contracts. I won't read this quote, but it's so funny, I think you should try and read it when I speak. And it is the case between American and English publishers. English publishers consider that Europe and their former colonies, like India, are their territories, and while American publishers try to extend their own territories. And some spaces are defined open markets. So you can see here, for instance, the British Antarctica, which is by a British publisher. So that's it. The dynamics of globalization stimulated the local book industry in many countries. As a result, cultural exchange increased. The number of books in translation in the world grew from 50,000 published in 1980, so the only year 1980, to more than 75,000 in the year 2000. So it's plus 50% of translation, according to the Index Translationum database, the UNESCO database of translation. In the 1990s, the average number of books in translation published annually was 25% higher than in 1980s. But this growth implied a diversification, as assessed by the number of connections between languages. In fact, far from favoring diversity, globalization has reinforced the domination of English, as you can see from these figures. The share of books translated from English reached close to 60% in the 1990s, was 45% in the 1980s. And this growth should be related to the drastic decline of the percentage of books translated from Russian, of course, after 1989. It fell from 11.5% to 2.5%, leaving only two central languages apart from English, which are French and German. So if we define centrality according to the fact that you export like 10% of the books in the world, you can see that Russian is no more in this category. So I'm using here the frame built by Johan Elbron, my colleague, who used the Wallachian and Abom de Swan's model for languages for center and periphery. And he applied this to translation. So you can see that among the semi-peripheral languages, and there are not many of them, there were like 7-8 languages which were between 1% and 3% in the 1980s, and all the other languages were less than 1%. So you can see that among these languages, there was Italian and Spanish. And Spanish is the only language which has strengthened its position from 1.7% to 2.6%, while Italian has kept its share around 3%. The share of all the other languages I said has fallen under 1%. Furthermore, contrary to what could be expected in the globalization era, the overall share of the peripheral languages decreased from close to 20%, as you can see, to 14%, and the average number of books translated every year from other languages was even smaller in the 1990s than in the 1980s. Thus, quantitatively speaking, diversity has diminished. The presence of some Asian countries, maybe China and Korea, has clearly grown, while Japan has strengthened its position largely because of the success of the Japanese comics, the mangas. Some areas remain excluded from the exchanges, like many African countries, where the publishing industry is not very developed and the book trade is dominated by large companies from the former colonial states like France and the UK. The other aspect of the fact that translations circulate mainly from core to periphery is that if you change the perspective from exportation to importation and look what happens, what is the case of translation in different countries of the importation of foreign literature, you can see that the share of translations in the national book production increases as we move from dominant or central countries in this market to the dominated or peripheral ones. So the share of translations in 1990 was only 3% in the United States and in the UK. In the overall book production, it was around 18% in France and Germany. Maybe it's less, I think it's less now in Germany. And 25% in Italy and in Spain, 35% in Portugal, 65% in Korea. So the more you are preferred, the more you translate. Being central means that you export more than you import. The ratio of the numbers of French books exported in translation and the number of books translated into French is positive. It means that France export more than import with all languages, but English, of course. Studying the flows of translation thus gives us a picture of the structure of the world market of translation. It can also provide data about what kind of books are circulating. But to understand the choices and the mechanism of selection, we need to complete this data with a field work on the agents involved in the cultural transfer. Translation is in fact mediated by agents, both individual and institutional, translators, publishers, critics, booksellers, literary agents, state agency representatives. And for these agents, translation can fulfill various functions in the economic, political, and cultural realms. Here, Bourdieu's field theory appears to be useful in order to understand the variety of motivations. The concept of field takes precisely these different logics and kinds of motivation into account, economic, political, cultural, literary in our case, but it could be intellectual, scientific, according to the kind of production we're talking about. Agents can act out of motivations that are neither political nor economic. Many translators translate without getting an income out of it, or a very small one. You must know that. Some publishers are ready to lose money when they translate a work, and their motivation can be purely intellectual or aesthetic. So this is an extract of an interview I did with a small American publisher. I discovered that there are a lot of such publishers in the United States. I just read the first this first words, we love success, but we don't have shareholders we have to please. Our fundamental mission is to do good books and raise the level of conversation always. So this is what the sociologist Max Weber has called rationality according to values, as opposed to profit. Even more specific to our concern is Bourdieu's work on the publishing field, to which he dedicated two seminal papers, one published in 1977, and the second in 1999, and the second one was an empirical work on the transformation of French publishers, and it's his last empirical work. And he was getting very upset with the growing heteronomy of the publishing field, out of economic interest, of course. So Bourdieu distinguishes the pool of large-scale circulation, which we can identify with mass markets, from the pool of small-scale circulation. The law of the market rules the pool of large-scale circulation, where sales are the main criteria for measuring success of books. By contrast, at the pool of small-scale circulation, we have aesthetic or intellectual criteria, which are provided by peers, judgment, writers, literary critics, and these criteria prevail over the large public sanction. Though it denies economic profits, presenting itself as an economic world reversed, in Bourdieu's terms, this function is not entirely devoid of economic rationality. Symbolic recognition by the peers is likely to bring, in the long run, a larger consecration of the work and of its author. When a work is canonized as a classic and included in anthologies, academic programs and literary textbooks, it becomes a profitable product for its publisher. So this conversion of symbolic capital into economic capital requires a long-run process, as opposed to the search of short-term profit that is typical of the commercial pole of the book industry. And it differentiates the economy of cultural industries based on the production of prototypes from that of the random industrial production. So for instance, when Camus was translated in the United States in the late 1940s, his agent, which came after a famous literary agent, George Borchardt, sold the rights of L'Étranger $500. And that, as you know, L'Étranger became a book in the secondary school program and was selling 1 million copies every year. Of course, Noro Camus, neither his hair nor his hat, because he was dead in 1961, enjoyed the profit of this, but the publisher did. So Bourdieu tested this theory at a national level, but it is very useful for a transnational perspective. First, it allows to compare the structure of the publishing field in different countries, as I did for France and the United States, focusing on translation. Moreover, the opposition between the pole of large-scale and small-scale circulation can be transposed to the world market of translation. So the world market of translation is split between this pole of large-scale circulation, where circulate products like, which literary agents call themselves commercial. They will ask you, you want a commercial book. These are the worldwide bestsellers, thrillers, romantic novels, and a pool of small-scale circulation where we find what agents themselves call literary upmarket books. Well, the pool of large-scale circulation has its international actors, scouts, foreign right persons, literary agents. Publishers at the pool of small-scale circulation have, as already suggested, their own networks in the specific relatively autonomous fields, writers, literary critics, translators for the literary field, academics for the scientific fields. And these international networks embody the elective affinities between publishers in different countries, a factor which is often mentioned by them in interviews as important. So they would check what this publisher has translated and maybe would be get interested in the book that was translated from Hungarian by this Italian publisher. And these affinities also express a homology of position in different national publishing fields. So I will now turn to the case study comparing the position of translation in the American and French publishing industry. As I said, two old and central industries. So the hyper-central position occupied by France since the 18th century has declined since the Second World War and being replaced by the United States. And I should rather speak about Paris and New York because there is such a concentration, much more in Paris than New York, as you will see. I think here the national frame hides this concentration around cities. So let me first point out the differences between these two industries. There are differences regarding the legal status of firms. The distinction between trade and not-profit in the United States, like in the UK, is much less important in France. Differences regarding cultural policies. There is, as you know, no American equivalent to the French book policy, especially regarding translation. And the division of labor within the book industry, in particular the central role of literary agents in the United States, which had no equivalent in France. But if we consider now the structure of the field of publishing according to Bourdieu's theory of the publishing field, we can find out some homologies. For instance, the not-for-profit status allocated to the publishing houses, which claim to fulfill intellectual mission, can be regarded as a structural equivalent to the cultural policies, which support only upmarket products for their intellectual or aesthetic interests. That's the opposition, so we have a private funding and a public funding, but it has the same function. And it is there to counter the law of the market. That's the opposition between the field of large-scale production and the field of small-scale production partly overlaps the previous opposition between trade and non-profit in the United States, or in France between books that are supported by cultural policies and those that are not, which are more entertainment or practical books. But this overlapping is only partial, of course. And the existence of this structure in the Anglo-American publishing field was confirmed by John Thompson's recent book, you might know, Merchants of Culture. It's about the Anglo-American publishing transformation of the contemporary Anglo-American publishing field. And I also found this opposition in my research on translation, this structure. So regarding translation, the big difference between the two poles is that English is dominant at the pole of large-scale production. This explains what, at this pole, most translated books everywhere in the world are from English, and why there are so few translations in English also, because at the pole of large-scale circulation, there are no translations almost. No sentimental novel, no thrillers translated from other languages. And everywhere else, the translation from English competes even with the national language. So here, linguistic diversity is very low at the pole of large-scale circulation. On the contrary, the position of translation at the pole of small-scale circulation is very important, and linguistic diversity is very high, especially in literary translation, because of the historical link between literature and the nation. In France, literary publishers translate up to 20, 30 foreign languages and from 40 different countries in specific foreign literature series, and there are many small publishers in France, as in the United States, which specialize in peripheral languages. The number of translated books in French has grown twofold from 1980 to 2000, twice more than the world average, which is, as I said, 50%. And this could be an indicator of the relative decline of the position of France in the world market of translation, because as you saw, the more you import, the more peripheral you are. Translation was indeed fostered by the implementation in 1989 of the translation policy, which supports not only the exportation of French culture, but also the importation of foreign literature in France. And this is a very specific, which has no equivalent in other places. So this policy is aimed at sustaining small languages in front of the domination of English. So you can see that this policy supported the translation, for instance, in the late 1990s of translations from 30 languages, which got this financial support, though if you look at the percentage, of course, 70% are from English. So in the United States, a movement in favor of translations emerged around 2002, and it was followed in the United Kingdom. Translating was conceived of by some publishers, which were belonging to the literary art market production, as a means to combat the growing hegemony of English in the world and the closure of American culture, as revealed by the dramatic fall of the share of translation in the American book production. The context was a growing awareness of the need to bring foreign voices with regards to the very low share of translation. I mentioned the 3%. And also there was a website created which was called, ironically, 3%, which was presented, this figure was presented as a problem, I'm quoting, as pretty embarrassing by the intermediaries involved in this movement. Some of them underscore the political dimension of the need for translation, so I won't read you, you can just have a look at it. But you can see also the context of the Bush years. She's saying we've been so unable to assimilate and learn about other cultures. And it's a publisher in a big conglomerate, but she has the upmarket imprint. An online literary magazine was launched titled Words Without Borders, and it aims at promoting a globalization of cultural exchange by bringing foreign voices from other languages to the United States. And it has published in 2010 1,000 pieces from 114 countries and 18 languages. So you can see the extract of their presentation, such presentation. And you can see they use the notion of international literature, which is more prestigious than translation, to value. And also they try to combat the image of this trend being elitist, because it defends upmarket literature. The Pen Club American Center played an important role in this movement. As you know, it was founded. The Pen Club was founded after the First World War in order to promote understanding among nations, and it fostered literary exchange and defends freedom of expression throughout the world. And in 2005, the Pen American Center launched the World Voices Festival of International Literature, and also it created the Translation Prize in order to value translation. And I just want to.
4 or 5 years ago, out of a kind of deep concern that many of us in Penn had, that in the climate of those days, that somehow the conversation between the United States and the rest of the world was breaking down. You know, in the immortal words of Kevin Costner, if you build it, they will come. And for me, that became almost the motto of what we did, that we produced this thing not really knowing what kind of response it would have. It had this colossal response. one of the things that Pat and I have been very concerned about is the relative paucity of translations into English that are published in the United States. So it's very difficult for American readers to be aware of what's happening in the rest of the world when the writers work is not offered to them in their own language. And this country, you know, has a very poor record in translation. I think it's something like 2%. 2% of the books published in this country were originally written in other languages. And that's, you know, horrible. Even if you compare it to other English language countries, such as England, that's a shockingly low figure. The English figure is like 3 times that.
Now I want to show you an illustration of the marginal position of translated literature in the American literary field by its place in the Brooklyn Book Festival. So in 2010, the international stage was set in an open space, it was raining, requiring no entrance tickets, in contrast with the events around famous American authors. You can compare, for instance, the invitation of Bret Easton Ellis in the Festival America in France at the same moment. So you can see the contrast, as you see, there were some translators from Greek, there was a Russian poet, the woman, there were Polish poets also. And only one meeting at the international stage of the Brooklyn Book Festival was dedicated to international literature. The others concerned genres like the graphic novel or the international noir, or themes like food or foreign destination and destinies. And there were 3 publishing houses represented, New Direction, an old but small independent house, and 3 young non-profit presses, Archipelago, Zephyr, and Ugly Duckling. As I said, there was a Polish poet, a Russian poet, translated from the Greek, and the choice of poetry is a way also to distinguish themselves from the commercial pole of publishing dominated by fiction. And the author, translator Susan Bonofsky, thanked the publishers to invest in translations that are less profitable than works in English. So this reflects the position of translated literature in the United States. Translations are increasingly abandoned by the trade publishers and taken over by the non-profit sector. Among the reasons for their increasing reluctance to bring out books by non-American writers, several publishers evoke as a decisive factor the concentration of ownership in the book industry, which is dominated by a few conglomerates. They have produced an intensifying fixation on profit. So you can see examples of extract of interviews that in the past a book did not have to sell so many copies to become doable. And as publishers focus on blockbusters, they steadily lose interest in leading known authors from other countries. Other reasons mentioned are the lack of staff editors reading foreign languages and the high cost of translation and also the local references and also the different writing. Moreover, it appears that when they do publish translations, publishers tend not to present them as such. It's not written on the cover that it has been translated, out of the fear that retailers will skip them, and then it won't be available in any bookstore of the chain. And you can see also an extract of interview. So although traditional prestigious publishing houses, which have become imprints in large conglomerates like Farrar, Post, Giroux, Knopf, Harcourt, and Pantheon continue to play a significant role in importing literature from foreign languages. Most translations, around 80% in 2008, are published either by non-profit presses, which mention it as part of their mission. And the New Press, for instance, is also kind of... it's a non-profit, but also by academic presses that publish literary translations. That's a very specific American thing, that you find literature translated by academic press. I don't think it exists here in the UK. And especially the Nebraska University Press. And you also find small independent trade publishers, like I mentioned already, New Directions, but also younger one, like Seven Stories or Arcade. Since the end of the 1990s, a new generation of publishers launched small presses, most of them not-for-profit, devoted to, as I said, international literature, a term that they prefer to translation because translation has been devalued on the book market. And so you have Archipelago, Open Letter, which both translate from a wide range of languages, some of them being specialized in areas, as Aflame, who publishes fiction from what they call the warm world, which is the ex-third world. They can rely for this purpose on the support of nation states, which implemented, as I said, translation policies. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to fund all this translation. And the terms they use to describe their activity is mission, vision, labor of love, pleasure, magical, all terms opposed to the rationalization of profit governing the commercial logic of the large conglomerates. So you can see an example, an extract of interview. So now I would like to compare geographically the concentration of translations from French in the Anglophone area and from English in the Francophone area, just to mention what I said before. So what can you conclude from this data? There are, of course, much more translations from English to French than the other way around, but it appears that the Francophone one area is much more concentrated around Paris, which is an old central, an older center, while New York shares since the 1960s the centrality with London in the Anglophone area. Thus, you can see the trace of the historical structure of this market and its present circulation pattern. So this is where the translations are published, the place where they are published. And you can see at the third level, that the level of the city, you can see that the American publishing is less concentrated around New York than the French around Paris. And for instance, this is a map of the literary translations from the French in the United States. And the spread, of course, there is the center around New York and another center around Los Angeles, California. But of course, this spread is all the university presses. So now, just to end, what is translated? So we constructed a database of books translated from French into the United States between 1990 and 2003. And so I will first focus on the literary authors translated from French into English. If we look at the characteristics of the translated authors, we can also observe phenomena of domination. First, gender, of course. Only 20% of translated works were written by women. This percentage raises up to 33% if we consider only contemporary literature. And this is despite the fact that the American market is very open to female authors, much more than other countries. So, in general, as a rule, male authors' works have more chance to circulate in translation. So now there is the national issue. If we look at the nationality of the authors translated, this is all French literature, all French literature. So you can see that this is a very, there is a variety of nationalities represented in French literature. But 3/3 of the authors translated from French are French, which means that the periphery is less represented, despite the growing interest in this literature, especially from African and Arabic countries. But the range of nationalities represented is very large. We have more than 30 nationalities. And this reveals how much the idea of national literature is, of course, a myth, even though we cannot deny the fact that there are national literary traditions. However, national literatures are also heterogeneous and cleaved between different trends, some of them being more internationally oriented, whereas others are more anchored in these national traditions, as Pascal Casanova argues. And, of course, the national origin of authors is just an indicator of diversity, which does not indicate much about the content of and trends of their work, so we should work more afterwards on the products, the translated products. And now let's turn to the characteristics of the translated works according to the genre. So this is the literary genre of translated French literature in the United States. And a quick look at this genre shows that works translated from French are mainly upmarket. If we compare to the translation from English into French during the same period, you can see that the science fiction and the mysteries occupy a much more important percentage in translations from English into French than the other way round. You can see here that the mysteries are only 6%, and I don't see that science fiction is 3%. But you can see that poetry is important and theater is important, two genres which are not profitable at all. So of course the number of translations is very, very different. There are much more translations, as I said, from English to French than the other way around. But still you can see the share, the different share, which shows that what is translated from French, French literature is much more upmarket literature. Though in this upmarket literature they usually look for the most commercial, those which sell the best. So it confirms the idea that English is dominant at the pole of large-scale production, while other languages prevail at the pole of restricted production. And last point, we can observe a phenomenon of concentration of works originally published by houses with a high symbolic capital. And you can see in this figure that Gallimard, I think you know the name of this publisher, it's also a sign, you don't know the other ones, Gallimard concentrates 29% of the books translated from French, literary books translated from French in the United States. So it's a sign of symbolic capital. It's not the same, I just did now the research on the figures of translated of translation of social sciences and humanities, and here is the Le Seuil, who is the editor of Barthes, Bourdieu, who arrived first and not Gallimard. Yeah. So you can see that in literature, Gallimard still has this... and you can see also that the share of translation is not related to the size of the publisher, because, for instance, you have Minuit, which is Lisson Minuit, which is the editor, the publisher of the Nouveau Roman, which is a very, very small house, which publishes very few books every year, but still it arrives on the third position, same place as Grasset, which is much larger and more commercial publisher. And the most important thing is that the publishers of all the authors I showed you, with the different nationalities and all this, most of them are Parisians. So this is the hidden variable of the circulation of books, that an African author has a chance to be translated, if he writes in French, to other languages, if he is published in Paris, and not if he is published in Africa. So the chance to be translated is much higher if you are published by a central publisher in a central country. And of course, if you got won prizes like the Goncourt, so this is rises the symbolic capital of the author. Yeah, you can see the publishers, I don't know if it's very interesting for you, but publishers who publish translations from the French. So to conclude, we saw that the circulation of... one more. Oh, these are the names, maybe it's more fun. we saw that the circulation of books within world market of translation is asymmetrical. Exchanges between languages and countries are unequal. Although globalization increased these exchanges, it has not fostered cultural diversity, on the contrary. Nevertheless, the growing domination of English arose a movement in favor of translation in the United States and in the UK. The movement conceived of translation not only as a culture, but also as a political cause in favor of diversity. In France, this cause is a cause entendue, supported by the government, which implemented a translation policy. This movement is still imbued with the myth of national literatures and the notion of authenticity. Literature is considered as tightly linked to cultural identity. Consequently, aesthetic criteria are combined with political ones in the selection process to ensure a cultural diversity. Moreover, due to the selection effects at a national level, writers who are male, rooted in the country for a long time, well-educated, and living in central cities are more likely to access the international scene than women, immigrants, writers coming from a lower social origin and or from the province. And the change has occurred with the world literature, of course, the notion of world literature, but it happened mainly in the centers, and most of these authors of the world literature are published by the centers. But should we suppress this national bias? The risk is high that it profits to central languages rather than to the peripheral ones in the global market of translation. I will give two examples to illustrate this risk. First example, in the rare, prestigious literary series that do not separate in France works in translation from works in French, there are hardly books translated from any other language than English. And this contrast, so if you have a foreign literature series, you have to diversify languages and have more and more exactly different languages. So it's so a principle imposed by the various editions of the series. Though it seems ridiculous today to separate national literature from foreign literature, translated literature, still, and the French literature series, as you know, englobe, of course, not only French, but also Quebec, African, every literature written in French. There is a confusion between national and nation and language here. But this confusion profits to peripheral languages in the foreign literature series. So should we suppress this today in France? It doesn't exist in the Anglo-American market, this distinction. So, and this probably also explains the fact that the figures of translation are so low. So should we suppress it? There is a risk that there will be much less diversity in the linguistic origin of the works in translation. The second case is that, as I said, most non-Western writers who get access to the international scene write in central languages, usually the one of the colonizer. And they publish with a publisher located in one of the centers of the global market. And this has been shown by one of my former PhD students, Claire Ducourneau, who published, finished a PhD dissertation on African writers since the independence. So the condition for them to access international scene is for those who publish in France and in Paris mainly, by contrast with those who publish in Africa. Thus the question would be how to suppress the national framing of the circulation of literary works at the pole of small-scale production, without reinforcing the domination of the centers, especially the American one. So, thanks for attention. Answer in a very synthetic way. Of course, there are connections, and I think it's totally related. There is research being done on pharmaceutical in sociology, and you can see that there are a lot of homologies, though there are also specificities like this embeddedness of the literature in the national framework, which is very specific. Of course, copyright is central in this issue because the very laws on copyright were first done to protect the national markets. But it's also an issue about the relationship between center and periphery, because it was also to protect the national dominant countries against the periphery, who were reproducing the books. And as I said, for instance, the French state supported the Parisian publishers against the province publishers. So there was support always to dominance. So it has helped. The structure of the market was partly the result of this process of using copyright law to reinforce the domination of these centers by the states. And of course, there are many issues about copyright, and I've been working in my last book on the issue of the freedom of the thought. So I'm very interested in the struggles around freedom. I'm very interested in law and literature, this issue of law and literature, and I've been also working on the history of the droit d'auteur. And there are also very interesting comparisons between copyright and droit d'auteur. Now there is a rereading of the French Revolution by Carlyle essay, for instance, showing that it's not the way it was interpreted by French jurists as a pure a pure expression of property, but much more it was considered as a reward of the state to the writer for in exchange of the service he gave to the nation. So it's a very different conception of copyrights, which should be used today, because as you know, the laws of copyrights was first only for 7 years, and then it's extended, and now it's 70 years, and now some try to fight to extend it to 100 years. And of course, there is all this movement in favor of copyleft, which poses the question of the retribution of the authors. How can we find a commercial model alternative which would allow to retribute the writers? And in France, in the 1960s, there was a project during 1968 to create the CNRS of the writers. it's interesting because the CNRS, the National Center for Scientific Research in France, was created the same year in 1930, like the Caisse des Lettres, which today became the Centre National du Livre, and which today is mainly devoted to help publishers and not authors. And where at the beginning it was for authors. So there is an appropriation of the public funds by the publishers. And of course, this is specific not only to France, though in countries like the UK and United States, you don't have such policies. But you can see that, I think that the philanthropic foundations do have grants and help the authors, but it's also help to the publishers. But still, do you need publishers? That's the issue. Also. Some publishers do a lot of work, some don't. So that's also an issue today.
Well, it's becoming increasingly an issue for us academics, because we're now totally embroiled in that too.
Yeah, totally. So I'm also working on that, and also the translation from. But as I said, the problem of translation in the United States, for instance, is having people, readers who are able to read in the other languages. And so it's interesting that there is, for instance, there was this woman in the publishing house who told me, French is my gateway language for all the Arabic world, because she was waiting for words to be translated into French to be able to read the words, because she didn't have they don't like to give it to readers, to external, they do it something, so sometimes, but they prefer to read by themselves, really. Usually the editors. And publishers, they used to have staff editors who were reading French, German, and maybe Spanish. And now Spanish is becoming, of course, stronger, but still it's very limited. And sometimes you don't have the skills. For instance, I interviewed a Chilean publisher, and he wanted to translate something from Korean, but how can he read it? So he would wait for the book to be translated into French to be able to read it. So the centers have a role in also the circulation of peripheral literatures from one place to another. And the linguistic skills are a very important thing. The fact that translation rose in France, I spoke about the position of France, but it's also the fact of the development of the training of in languages. The INALCO, for instance, which accompanied the geographic extension of translation into French to beyond the European borders. And so I think it's totally linked. And also the norms of translation, that's an interesting issue, I think, is linked to the institutionalization of teaching of languages, because norms of translation, of course, vary across cultures, but also within the same culture, they vary according to the kind of literature you're dealing with. So you have norms of fidelity, faithfulness, high-level translation for upmarket literature, but these norms are not at all the same for commercial literature, where you can change whatever, or for children's literature, where when it was...
Again, agencies change there, because the policing may be done within academia at one time, in one place, for instance, while it's entirely left to a different area in another, so the agencies involved.
Yes, it's the agency, but it's also the norms that the translators and the expectation from the publishers is important, because in children's literature it was used to, you know, change the names and change the color of the head and of the eyes and just to adapt to the culture. So now there is a different trend, because depends, but for instance, Gallimard interviewed the editor in charge with the children, youth literature, and they translated Harry Potter. And so I asked her about the norms, and she said, oh, we are very respectful of the text and of the... So they imported the norms of literary text to children literature but it is Gallimard, you know, so they have to, even when they do, they have a series of mysteries, I'm sure they apply literary norms to this series much more than a random publisher of thrillers. So.
But what you're saying is also very interesting, because for instance, one of the things that we're seeing, which is paradoxical in a sense, is that this kind of circulation, what you were talking about also the lack of skills and missing skills, has led to a sort of resurgence of indirect translation, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily expect, but you see that happening now. Mm-hmm. So translations which people wait for the English translation or the French translation and then the next translation.
But they won't translate from the French, they wait to read it and they will translate from the original.
Well, in some
language.
Cases, but and in some cases they also...
In some cases, but yeah. Indirect translation has been historically reduced because of the norms of exactly, because yeah. of the norms of... Yeah, that's an important point.
Yep. Thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. I'm struck by your point about globalization increasing the inequalities between languages. I was looking at different possible strategies of resisting that. And is there any evidence of the refusal to be translated, a non-translation as a strategy, or strategies that translations that bypass the core? So, for example, from Welsh into Catalan, mm-hmm. for example, is one
yes.
possible.
Yeah.
And the second question I've got is about kinds of English. Because in the literary field, we're always taught about, you know, that English ceased to be the language of the English a long time ago, and there are many Englishes. Is it possible to think about translation from the small Irish presses, English language Irish presses, or English language Welsh presses, for example, differently to the way that we think about big presses in London or New York?
Yeah, thank you. So that's a very important issue. There are strategies, there are lots of strategies. Refusal to be translated, the only case I really know is a Dutch author of the 1930s who refused, he once read the translation of his book, I think it was in French, and he was so horrified about the quality of the translation that he refused to be translated. Now he's been retranslated and he refused to be translated anymore. And that's another issue, a very problematic, that we can discuss the quality of the translation. Because I spend my time defending translation against it. But sometimes when I look at the translation and I've been translated and I work on the, when I look at the translation, I just also horrified. especially in the social sciences and humanities. The very interesting thing is those strategies of that you mentioned, Catalan, Welsh. So the small countries like not countries, the small languages like Catalan and Galician, who are fighting, who are trying to establish themselves as national languages, or trying to get autonomy. They are in this struggle totally, and they try to get the rights of books. Before the Castilian publishers, of course. So there is a kind of competition, and you can observe the same thing with the Latin American publishers. I did some interviews there, and it's really fascinating because you can see what hegemony means. It's not only economic, it's also cultural. I remember I interviewed this small Chilean, there were two. There was one who was an independent small who created this publishing house in the 1990s, and he was trying to get, and he said, from the moment I get another with some success, then he would switch to a Spanish larger publisher. So they had a hard time getting the rights from the first publishers. And the other interview I did was with a publisher who was the head of the I forgot to say the filial. It was the link to a big
branch.
Group,
yeah, the local branch,
local branch of a big group, and so I was interviewing and said, with the door closed. She said, okay, so I want to tell you it's really cultural hegemony, because you know, most famous Latin American authors publish in Spain. In his branch, he's allowed to publish some Chilean authors, but these authors, to get the right to publish them outside Chile, they need to sell 40,000 copies. I don't know if you imagine what means selling 40,000 copies in Chile. To get diffused, distributed in Spain, they have to reach 100,000 copies in Chile. This is ridiculous. And those same, of course, those same expectations don't apply to Spanish authors. So the fight is on, for instance, French publishers, they try to split the rights, for instance, between English and American publishers, but they will never give the rights to an Indian publisher as well, though now there are some who are rising and becoming very important in the market. And of course, the author himself, you know, he knows he has most chance to be diffused in the world if he publishes with a Penguin and with this young Indian publisher, though he is very, very, very dynamic and very. So this is a real problem, because the whole structure, the whole power relations is kept by the all the agents in the chain. But those who subvert the system, or those at the periphery who are very much struggling, like Canadian publishers now, they do co-publication with African publishers, and that's a great thing, but they overturn, you know, French publishers, so they are aligning with the periphery, with other peripheral publishers. So this is the way to combat. I remember a Galician colleague was very involved in the also the national movement in Galice, and who was trying to get, who told me, he told me we succeeded in getting the rights of Montelevision of Bordeaux before the Spanish, before the Spanish, the Castilian publishers.